Good afternoon, everyone. This year is the 50th anniversary of Honest to God, published by Bishop John Robinson, a book which in many ways not only had a great readership at the time, but marks something that had been going on for quite some time before it. So in this lecture, in some respects, you're going to hear as much about theology before Honest to God as I'm going to talk about its effects afterwards. This little book, like a penguin, but published by SCM, had a most unexpected reception. The writer himself was completely taken aback by what happened, and so much so that the publishers have republished it this year in exactly the same format as it appeared 50 years ago. Now, this book sold 1 million copies and was translated into 17 languages. Just think of that. No other religious book has been read by so many people in all of history. That's a very significant thing in itself. And thereafter, life in the church began to change rapidly. As Ruth Robinson, the bishop's widow, said 30 years later, things were never the same again. Not only for them, but in the life of the church. Well, why is that the case? And how did this change take place? That's what we're going to explore briefly. This small paperback revealed to the public things which surprised them. It revealed what theologians were thinking and had been thinking in some cases for quite some time. Now, those of us who were in theological education at the time didn't find anything very new in this book. That's a curious thing. Moreover, we were rather critical of it. We thought it wasn't very well written. Even John Robinson confessed he would have taken more pains over it if he had known it was going to be read so widely. It's not a particularly easy book to read for the layperson, and yet they read it. And in reading it, it opened up a Pandora's box. One of the reasons why we in theological education were a little bit critical of it and were surprised that it was being read so quickly is we hadn't realized we had been living in a ghetto in academia. And things had been going on in the academic theological world which the people in the pews knew nothing about. Now, what was in this book? What came out of this Pandora's box? Well, first of all, there was Paul Tillich. Now, Paul Tillich was a German theologian who was a chaplain in the First World War. And he later said that as he watched what was going on in the trenches in the First World War, his whole theology collapsed. And he went back and had to start and think through afresh. He hadn't got very far in that when the Nazis dismissed him from his post. He then went to America, where he was invited, and where he was given a position as a junior lecturer at Union Seminary. And there he had, first of all, to master the English language and then carry out a new way of thinking about God. Some of his earlier books were simply collections of sermons. But the very title tells you a lot, The Shaking of the Foundations. And then in 1952, he wrote a little book called The Courage to Be, which is really an explanation of what it means to have faith in this new 20th century context. And when he came to talk about God, he talked about God in an entirely new way. God is not a being, he said. God is being itself. God is the very ground of being. Well, all that in one chapter of Honest to God. And then came Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran clergyman who was at the forefront of theological thinking at the time, was imprisoned by Hitler on the charge that he had been engaged in a plot to kill Hitler, and he had, but they couldn't pin it on him. So he spent 2 years or more in prison, from which he wrote the seeds of a new theology, which was published after his death, and which was given the name of secular Christianity. And he began to think of Jesus not as the great cosmic savior which has come from the outer world, but as a man who taught us how to care for one another, and labeled Jesus the man for others. And then there was Rudolf Bultmann, the oldest of them all. And notice they're all three Germans. And Rudolf Bultmann had, as a New Testament scholar, been opening up a new way of understanding the New Testament. Because, as he said, the New Testament is written within a mythological framework which we all left behind a long time ago. And so to understand it, the New Testament must be demythologized, taken out of its mythical framework and expressed in another way. Now, in his preface to Honest to God, Robinson said, "Now, what I've tried to say in a tentative and exploratory way may seem to be radical, and doubtless to many heretical." It certainly was. "But the one thing which I'm fairly sure," he says, "that in retrospect it will be seen to have erred in not being radical enough." And that has proved very much to be the case. In particular, the headlines of the paper which announced its book said, "Our image of God must go." So, what Honest to God did was to question the whole way of understanding God that had been dominant for so long. And here it is. The old man in the sky. Well, of course, you might say, "Well, I haven't really thought of God as the old man in the sky." And I say, "Haven't you? Don't you say the Lord's Prayer? Our Father in heaven." And there's the picture of him, our Father in heaven. "And that image must go," said Robinson. Now, what surprised and shocked people was that this was written by a bishop. Now, theologians can be dismissed. They're merely academics. But bishops cannot be so easily dismissed. They are the guardians of Christianity. And here was a bishop confessing his doubts and his queries about Christianity in an open and honest way. That's the point of the title, Honest to God. Well, it's not surprising that the Church Times said, "It's not every day that the bishop goes on public record as apparently denying almost every Christian doctrine of the church in which he holds office. That's how it seemed to many to be. So there was widespread discussion and debate. So much so that only 6 months later, another book appeared, and this is called The Honest to God Debate. And this book contains a lot of the reviews, some of them favorable, some of them extremely critical, and also letters that have been written to the paper, and also letters that have been written to Robinson himself. But there is one particular essay written by a professor of philosophy at Oxford. His name is Alasdair MacIntyre, and he was an atheist. And in his statement, he congratulated Bishop John Robinson on coming out and expressing himself as an atheist like himself. And he concluded his statement with these interesting words: "The creed of the English is that there is no God, and it's wise to pray to him from time to time." Well, in 3 years later, in 1966, the April edition of Time came out. Is God dead? And what this article in Time, by the way, this particular cover is said to be one of the 10 magazine covers that have shaken the world. It was a shocker. And what this article was doing was simply drawing attention to a group of theologians, Altizer, Hamilton, Paul Van Buren, who were talking about the death of God, and also a Jewish death of God theologian, Richard Rubinstein. I'm going to mention both of those books in turn. Here's the first one. There's the book, The Death of God. And what you find here are simply a series of essays by Tom Altizer. By the way, I had the pleasure of hearing Tom Altizer speak in Britain about nearly 20 years ago now. And Hamilton gathered their statements together in this little book and called it Radical Theology and the Death of God. And in the course of these, they say things like this: God has died in our time, in our history, in our existence. And what they were saying is that the reality of God seemed to most people to be very real right up until quite recently, and it has become dead. Can there be a form of Christianity without a belief in God? That's the problem, they said, that we now face. At the same time, there came out a book by a Jew, Richard Rubinstein, After Auschwitz. And here was a Jew who said that the God who supposedly saved our ancestors at the Red Sea failed to do so at Belsen. And so he said, why do we carry on as Jews? Well, he says, Judaism is the way we Jews share our lives in an unfeeling and silent cosmos. It's a flickering candle that we light to darken us, to enlighten us and to warm us. It's something that we continue to do for ourselves. Now, in the very same year, Joseph Fletcher came out with his book, Situation Ethics. So he's the founder of the very idea of situation ethics. Now, what is situation ethics? Situation ethics is there are no absolute moral rules. There is one thing that is extremely important, he says, and that's love. But in any situation, you need to look at all the factors that come to bear upon them, take them into account, try to understand them and appreciate, and see what does love require you to do in that situation. It's a very demanding exercise. Some people dismiss this as simple. If there are no moral rules, you can do what you like. Far from it. If there are no moral rules, we have to make ethical decisions in all important situations ourselves. Situationism abandons all absolute moral rules except love. And it stands between legalism at the one extreme and antinomianism, that is, you do what you like, on the other. Well, it too caused a debate not unlike that of honest to God. And so some 2 years later, there came the situation ethics debate, 1968. Now you notice that all these things happening in the 1960s. Now let's turn to look at what I would call the turbulent 1960s. And it started off with Martin Luther King and his famous address when he said, leading the civil rights campaign, "I have a dream." And then came Robinson, same year, honest to God. Then came 66, the death of God, with Altizer and Rubinstein. And in the same year, 1966, situation ethics. And because you live in New Zealand, you should be aware of the fact that it was in the middle of this that we had our own theological controversy, the turbulent 60s. So let's look now at the New Zealand situation. And I'm sorry to say I've got to talk about myself at this point. I would have liked to have avoided it, but it's very difficult to do so and give you the full picture. So please excuse me. So let's look at the New Zealand theological controversy, 1965 to 1967. Many people have forgotten it started in 1965. What is more, most people don't know it started because of Robinson's Honest to God. Because 2 years after he wrote Honest to God, Robinson wrote A New Reformation. Well, just as that book appeared, I was invited by the editor of the Outlook to write an article for Reformation Sunday. Well, this book, what else could I do but write an article which was headed, "Is a New Reformation Possible?" Now, in the course of this, I said such things as, the Bible is not the written word of God in literal form, and the Bible is not an absolute guide on all religious thought and morals, because it belongs to the past, and we've moved on since then. Well, even that upset some people, and so Bob Blakey immediately replied with another article, "The Religious Road to Atheism," he said. Well, here you have to understand that there's always a bit of a time delay. And the time delay was that his article couldn't be published until early 1966. Well, by that time, the editor of the Outlook had asked me to write now an article for the Easter edition of the Presbyterian paper. Well, just at that point, another book came out. It was Ronald Gregor Smith's Secular Christianity, which was in fact talking about the influence of Bonhoeffer, among other things. Well, in the course of this book, Gregor Smith says that the Christian is free to say that the bones of Jesus lie somewhere in Palestine, and he is not denying the resurrection. So I took up this and expounded it in my article, What Does the Resurrection Mean? Well, you know what happened then. All hell seemed to break out. Well, the church seemed to overcome it by its general assembly meeting and sort of paper over the cracks. But then at the beginning of the next year, I was invited to preach at the inaugural service at Victoria University. I was still down in Eden. So in the course of this sermon, it really wasn't about the subject at all, but in the course of this sermon, I happened to say, man has no immortal soul. And so it all broke out again, leading, of course, as you know, to the famous heresy trial. After that, I wrote, at the request of publishers, I never thought of myself as a writer at all, God and the New World, and then I wrote the book on the resurrection. So that all came out of the theological controversy here in New Zealand and was sparked off initially by Bishop John Robinson. So the 60s proved to be a very critical turning point in the life of the church and indeed in theological thinking. The decline in church attendance, which had been going on for 100 years, now rapidly accelerated. But what was of greatest even significance in that was the loss of young people from the church. The Bible class movement practically disappeared within two or three decades. And even the Sunday schools went downhill rapidly. It was just as if honest to God had blown the roof off the church and let a lot of fresh air in. Now, Robinson never intended to do this. In one sense, he was an unintentional whistleblower. In other words, he let everybody know what was going on in the academic world of theology. And it was a tremendous shock to them to find that was the case. So honest to God was not so much the cause of what happened as being a significant marker in a process of theological change that had been going on for quite some time. And that is why it is necessary for me to go back a while. We're going to go back now to see where it did really start. And we actually go back to the year 1799. A long way back, it seemed. Now, what happened in 1799? Well, there was published this book. I don't think you can see that terribly well. It's called On Religion. And this was written by Friedrich Schleiermacher, who, as a result of this, might be called the first modern theologian. That is, a man who theologizes within the modern cultural context. And this book was entitled On Religion, Speeches to Its Cultured Despisers. Now, the very title tells you something. Already at this point, from the Enlightenment onwards, there were a rationalist group of people who were turning away from religion altogether, and he was trying to speak to them and, as it were, to show that religion really had something in it after all. Now, this is the man himself. When he wrote this book, he was the hospital chaplain at the new Berlin hospital. As a result of the book, of course, he rose quickly in the theological world and was given theological chairs, first at Halle and later at Berlin, which was his main one. And he might be regarded as the father of liberal Protestantism. Now, the remarkable thing is, he was a greatly loved and highly respected man. He preached nearly every Sunday, as well as conducting his lectures at the university. He was so widely admired that at his funeral, he died in his 60s, at his funeral, practically the whole of Berlin turned out. Now, when you see some of the things he actually said, you'll be surprised there was no reaction against him. No. He carried people with him as he went along the way. Well, let's have a look. First of all, at the names of his chief books, that one on religion, Speeches to Its Culture Despisers, and then a tiny little book I'm going to talk to you about later called Christmas Eve, A Dialogue on the Incarnation. But his main book was simply called The Christian Faith. That's his magnum opus, published in 1821. Notice, it wasn't translated into English until 1928. Of course, if you read it today, you might think, well, that's all pretty orthodox, and you will not realize that he did come to a reasonably orthodox position, but from a very different base, as I shall later show. Now, as he was teaching theology in Berlin, there was a philosopher teaching philosophy. He was a person who started off to train for the ministry, by the way, and then turned to philosophy. His name is Hegel. Some of you may not have heard of the name of Hegel, but in the 19th century, he was the giant. So much so that as we look at him now, we can say, quote Paul Tillich, Hegel was the center and turning point of a world historical movement which has influenced our whole century. We wouldn't be where we are today if it hadn't been for Hegel. Why? Well, in many ways, Hegel sowed the seed of a progressive, ever-changing culture. Indeed, 50 years before Darwin's account of biological evolution, he had set the stage for our understanding the evolution of human ideas and human culture. Now, Hegel is not a particularly easy person to read. I'll try to sum up in one or two sentences what he had tried to do. He attempted to integrate all thought, everything, mind, nature, history, science, religion, into one great integrated philosophical system. This system could be shortened into this sentence: everything, including the physical world, has emanated from Geist. Now, that's a German word for which we haven't got the quite equivalent. It means both mind and spirit. And what he's saying is that the whole of the universe has emanated originally from mind. Now, in one sense, that's simply a highfalutin philosophical way of saying God made the world. God is spirit, and out of God, but instead of saying God made the world, he said the world has come out of God. It's come out of spirit. And everything that is physical now has emerged and is continuing to change as a result of its origin. What is more, he said, it progresses according to a certain pattern, which is known as a dialectical pattern. By that it means it throws up what we might call a thesis, and the thesis then produces the antithesis, and then the two of them join together in a synthesis. And so it goes along like that. And in some respects it's very interesting that he's caught not only the idea of progress, but the way in which progress goes along. Well, here is this great thinker at the beginning of the 19th century, and he produced three disciples who really shaped the century thereafter. I'll deal with the bottom one first, and that, of course, is Karl Marx. Karl Marx is the disciple of Hegel who now saw history as a dialectical process in which it is moving steadily towards the wonderful classless society at the end. Well, we all know a bit about that. Then there is David Strauss. He pioneered biblical study and saw the Bible as the result of an ongoing process in which we move from myth to history, and in which much of the New Testament itself has to be understood as preserving to our time the mythological framework of the first century. Then comes Ludwig Feuerbach, the first theologian to assert we humans made the concept of God. Now, I'm going to give you a little genealogy here. It's in sketch form, but I think it substantially holds up. At the beginning of the 19th century in Germany, there were these two great thinkers, in other words, Schleiermacher and Hegel. Now, what happened was that Schleiermacher had influenced Strauss, but Strauss was also influenced by Hegel, and then Strauss had influence. He was the one who influenced Bultmann in the 20th century, but Bultmann was also influenced by Schleiermacher. Then Schleiermacher influenced Torrance, at least Torrance. He wouldn't like that. Tillich. And Tillich, of course, was one of the mentors of Robinson. And here we are. Now, let's go back a little bit now, because Robinson also drew from Bultmann, as well as Torrance, as well. Oh, I keep saying that. He's the epitome opposite one. Tillich and Bultmann are two of the great figures in Honest to God. Now, let's go back to Schleiermacher. Schleiermacher influenced Feuerbach. Feuerbach went to Schleiermacher to train as a theological student. He hadn't been there too long before he realized, well, he was much more interested in what Hegel had to say. So he was influenced then by Hegel. And Feuerbach was the instrument in changing Karl Marx. Though Marx thought in the end that Hegel was the preferable one of the two, and so Marx is a product of both Feuerbach and Hegel. And Marx went on, of course, to produce in his dialectical communism a very atheistic point of view. Now, having got to that and into the 20th century, here we are in the 20th century when Karl Barth said Schleiermacher has led us astray. So he went back to orthodoxy before Schleiermacher and produced what is known as neo-orthodoxy, a new form of orthodoxy dressed up to meet the 20th century. In the meantime, however, Feuerbach had really pioneered the way of seeing religion as a human phenomenon, even though a very important human phenomenon. I mean, he starts his book by saying that the most important thing about being a human being is that only humans of all creatures have religion. Therefore, we must take notice of it. But It had brought an end to the idea that religion is something revealed from above, revelation theology. Religion is something which humans have created in the course of cultural history. And so Feuerbach went on to influence Rudolf Otto and subsequently, of course, Don Cupid. Now, just keep that in your mind. I'll just change it slightly in order to... Now, suppose you'd never heard of any of that. And that was the situation in 1963. Nobody in the pews, or very few, knew anything about it, what had gone before. And what they saw was extremes, neo-orthodoxy, or even just orthodoxy, and atheism. And here was Robinson appearing to be between the two and moving pretty fast towards atheism. And that is why the book was such a shock. Now I'm going to show three ways in which Schleiermacher triggered off the changes that in the end caused Robinson to drop what seemed to be a bombshell. Three ways in which he really set the stage for the modern situation, because these three ways also help to explain where we are today. In many respects, it goes back to Schleiermacher. And it shows why theology today is, as it were, in some disarray. Way one. Schleiermacher shifted the base on which to engage in the theological enterprise. How did he do this? Well, traditional theology, all orthodox theology, starts from God. It starts from the truths which are believed to have been revealed by God and contained in the Bible. In other words, traditional theology is theocentric. See, Karl Barth, who stands in this position, would want to say, you mustn't be critical of God. You must listen to what God says. You must listen to what God says in the Bible and then explore that within your context. Well, what Schleiermacher did was his theology started from humankind. It started from our own experience of the divine, if you want to call it that way. It's anthropocentric as against theocentric. That is a tremendously different change. In the end, there was so much, of course, in Schleiermacher's psyche and Christian experience that what he wrote didn't seem all that much different. But he had come to it from a different starting point. Now, I'm going to give some quotes from what Schleiermacher said in 1799. He wrote, "Religion answers a deep need in mankind. It's not a metaphysic. It's not a morality. It's feeling. Dogmas, the basis of orthodox theology, are not really part of religion. They are derived from religion. So you must go back to where religion has its seat. It's in our own experience, which is emotional as well as rational." He also wrote in that first book, "Belief in immortality is not necessarily a part of religion. The desire for personal immortality seems rather to show a lack of religion, since religion assumes a desire to lose oneself in the infinite, in the divine, not to perpetuate oneself for all time, preserve one's finite self. That is irreligion in Schleiermacher." Now this was 1799. Well, it set Feuerbach off straight away. So as a student of Schleiermacher, he then began to write a book, quite a longish book, at the age of 24, and it was published as Thoughts on Death and Immortality, in which he took Schleiermacher to its logical conclusion. No, we are finite creatures. There is no possibility of immortality for any of us. We have to learn to live life as we live it. So already there, he wrote that book at 24, and then he went on to write his magnum opus. Now, his magnum opus was called The Essence of Christianity, 1841. Now, he writes this book in two parts. In one part, he looks at the Christian inheritance from the theocentric viewpoint, which is Orthodox theology, and says that's wrong. Then he looks at it from the anthropocentric point of view, and that is reality. As he said, and I sum it up in this sentence, the theology, which literally means the study of God, when properly understood for what it is actually anthropology. It's the study of humankind, because in the concept of God, we project what we find to be of great value in our own life. And so we say, God is love, God is justice, God is compassion. These are our values. And so the study of God as the compassionate one is really the study of what we value. Now, Schleiermacher further wrote in 1799, belief in God is not necessarily a part of religion. Now, that's a bit of a shocker. One can conceive of a religion without God. Well, we've only got to go to the non-Christian religions to find that. And we consider that it would be a pure contemplation of the universe, which I have been finding is a very real experience, having just written From the Big Bang to God, the contemplation of the universe. Well, Ludwig Feuerbach, the student of Schleiermacher, as I say, turned to Hegel, but he used Schleiermacher's anthropological approach to turn Hegel upside down. He was the one who changed Marx by turning Hegel upside down. Mind you, he said, I'm not turning it upside down, I'm turning him the right way up. Well, I prefer to say, instead of turning him upside down, he actually turned it inside out. And I've got a little diagram to help you see that. How did Feuerbach turn Hegel inside out? Well, the theocentric approach was this. We start with God. We can portray God that way. Then God made the world, so we can portray the world that way. Then within the world came human culture, inspired by God, so we'll put that like that. That's how it used to be. No, said Feuerbach, it's the other way around. We must start with the world. So there it is. Then the world has produced life, and amongst humans it has produced human culture, like that. And then in some parts of human culture there has evolved the concept of God. It's a human symbol of meaning. And so there it is, at the center, whereas previously it seemed to be at the circumference of everything. Now, what Schleiermacher and Feuerbach pioneered is now actually coming to fruition in Robinson's Honest to God, in The Death of God Theologians, in Cupid's Religion of Life, and if I may say so, and in Kaufman's In the Beginning Creativity, whereas God is simply, not simply, but marvelously, the whole creative power that has brought us forth and is continuing in the universe. And this is what I've tried to express in Christianity Without God and From the Big Bang to God. Now, looking again at this genealogy, we can see that it is Strauss and Feuerbach that have brought the end of the idea of divine revelation and helped us to see religion is a human phenomenon which we have slowly evolved in order to find meaning and value and purpose in our lives, and has produced such people as Cupid and Kaufman. That was the first way he changed the base of doing theology from starting with God to starting with humankind. Now the second way in which he changed things was to switch from a starting point to a human, took theology out of the hands of the authoritative experts, the priests and the theologians, and democratized it. That is, we all have to do our own theology today. Theology has become a do-it-yourself exercise by which each person seeks to understand the God within and the God without in the way that is most meaningful to them. And so there's tremendous variety of theologies today, one for every person, really. Now, this particular way in which Schleiermacher set this, it's in his little book, Christmas Eve, A Dialogue on the Incarnation. I've only ever seen one copy of it, and I had to go to the British Museum in London to see it. It's a wonderful little piece. And you have to understand how he came to write it. Christmas was near at hand. He had a wonderful experience at a flute concert he'd been to. And he went home inspired by this and decided to write a little booklet to give to his friends as a Christmas present. And this was it. And he wrote this in 2 or 3 hours. And in it he describes a scene in which a number of people, women and men, gather together on Christmas Eve and discuss what Christmas means to them. Hence, dialogue on the incarnation. And in this discussion, the women, who aren't named by the way, they start off the discussion. And one of them says that for her, Mary represents every mother. And the other said, yes, you're right. And my child is for me the Christ child. And so they draw attention to what Christmas means for them out of their own experience. And after they have been talking for some time, then, as you might imagine, the men take over and they never get another look in. Well, there is Leonard. Now, he's the intellectual, rather skeptical kind. He's not quite sure of what we read in the Bible's true after all. How much do we really historically know about Jesus, he says. Well, he's followed by Ernst, who's a little put out by that, and he counters Leonard's skepticism and says, yes, but you've got to fit this into your own personal experience, the way these women have been doing, he says, and think of the joy at Christmas and how important that is. And so somehow God has come into our lives at Christmas in a new and wonderful way. And then comes Edward, and he's rather more speculative. He says, now, in John's Gospel, there's no reference to Christmas at all. There's no birth story there. And so John's Gospel leads me to sort of understand reality in a rather mystical way. Indeed, he says, humankind is really the spirit of the earth. It's life's coming to know itself in its eternal being, in its ever-changing process of being. Indeed, he reflects thinking that was going on at that time, which later came to fruition. Well, rather late in the evening, there arrives another person, Joseph. Now, he's a rather naive, pious, evangelical in many ways, you would say he was today. And he's shocked to find these men arguing with one another, on Christmas Eve, arguing with one another. So he tries to calm the whole thing down, and he does so in the end by getting them round the piano and having a sing-song and a clapping, and a hand, you know, hand clapping or lovely. And so the evening ends like that. Now, when you have read that in the light of what's happened in the last 200 years, it's a very interesting parable of what has happened in the Christian, in Christendom. There are those who have remained loyal. There are those who have been skeptical. There are those who have moved away from it. And there are, of course, the pious evangelicals and the fundamentalists. It's an interesting parable of what was happening if we take theology down to a democratized level. That's us, and we do it ourselves. Now we come to the third way in which Schleiermacher has influenced. Schleiermacher's switch from a divine starting point. Oops, time. I'm sorry about that. From a divine starting point to a human one led to the modern situation by opening up the way for our dispensing with the word God altogether. Now, remember what he said? Belief in God is not necessarily a part of religion. One can conceive of religion without God, and it would be pure contemplation of the universe. So, now, through Honest to God and up to 1993. And that was the 30 years anniversary of the book. And another book came out, 30 Years of Honesty. Well, that's when Ruth Robinson, by the way, at this point, the BBC Radio ran a very interesting series of talks on radio about Honest to God and what had happened or failed to happen as a result. Well, Ruth said things have never been the same again, while the editor of the SCM Press, who brought out the book, said, very sadly, I remember hearing this sadness, and there has been no reformation. We suffered a loss of nerve. So, where's theology today? Well, let me give you three examples. One is John Cobb. I last saw John Cobb in the rest home in Los Angeles. I'm not sure. I hope he's still alive. I'm not sure. I haven't heard of his death. Now, he tried to take over from Teilhard de Chardin and early philosopher Whitehead a new way of thinking of God as the evolving process itself, and tried to develop on the basis of that what's known as process theology, and in the book, a Christian natural theology. Then comes Gordon Kaufman from Harvard. Gordon Kaufman went through quite a long spiritual pilgrimage from something fairly traditional to begin with, but his book, his first book is very interesting by its title, God the Problem. And he wrestled with this all of his life, and his last year or two wrote, in the beginning, creativity. Creativity is his way of thinking of the divine reality in all that it has brought forth and continues to bring forth in us and in our own thinking. And then, of course, is Don Cupid, who is also still writing. His significant book in this respect was Taking Leave of God in 1980, but his more recent books have turned, as it were, to the importance of life, the religion of life. And he's drawn attention to the way in which in ordinary people more and more rarely use the word God, except in such frozen expressions as, oh God, and talk about life and how to get on with life and how to move in life, move forward from such tragedies as they've had. And so in this book, The New Religion of Life in Everyday Speech is one that expresses this. Life itself has become theology, theologized. Life is a self-propagating, self-giving power that is everywhere around us and within each living thing. Now, as a result of many other things, but including Robinson at the center, this image of God had to go. It was too small, too human, too personal, too objective. But God remains as a very important symbol from our past. We may use it, we don't have to use it. But if we use it, it refers to whatever transcends us. We can use it to help us grasp the unity of the universe and all that goes on in it. And in this shift, in this transition, there's been a shift from interest in orthodoxy, that is, right belief, to an interest in orthopraxy, right action. And that's where love becomes so extremely important, right action. And a person who's written on this, who is a Jew, by the way, not a rabbi, however, God is the good we do. We had him lined up to give a lecture here this year, but unfortunately he had to pull out. And that's what he wrote in 2007, God is the good we do. Well, to summarize, Honest to God was a very significant marker in a long transition from Schleiermacher to us, in which we have changed from a traditional Christian and theistic base to the non-theistic, post-Christian, secular character of the world we live in today. It started with Schleiermacher. It has led, unfortunately, to the increasingly rapid decline of the churches. And this transition is particularly to be seen as visible in such progressive Christian churches as this one or the Sea of Faith Network. They are pointing, as it were, to the changes that have been taking place. Now, just as the Enlightenment gave us freedom to think, so in the realm of theology, and theology might be defined as the philosophy of life, in the realm of theology, we are increasingly becoming do-it-yourselfers today. So that's a brief account of the modern dissolution of orthodox or traditional theology. Now it's over to you and me.
Thank you, Lloyd, for